Hey folks, Mackenzie Lambert here, your host for Mac and the Movies. Today we have a very special episode. I've had a chance to catch up on some of my back catalog. I'm going to be sharing with you my thoughts on three films. We've got the movie adaptation of Darkest Dungeon, the Black Widow solo movie for the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and the Ken Burns mock documentary adaptation of Max Brooks's World War Z. Without further ado, let's get into the movies. Darkest Dungeon opens with an introduction similar to the video game, accompanied by the vocal talents of Wayne June. A passenger in a carriage, hidden in shadow, holds a letter. The ancestor has sent a letter to the passenger to return home after an evil has been unleashed. Before venturing back home, the passenger put out a bounty, calling for the best warriors to arrive to the nearby hamlet. There, the passenger will hire those deemed worthy of the task. The passenger arrives at the hamlet and sees there is much commotion coming from the tavern. Inside, there is a small army of warriors vying for the bounty. We see the entire roster of characters from the game, including but not limited to the occultist, the musketeer, the plague doctor, the grave robber, the abomination, the man-at-arms, the hellion, and the crusader. Suddenly, the tavern is attacked by vengeful spirits, terrorizing those within. As quickly as they arrive, they disappear. The only survivors are the occultists, the plague doctor, the abomination, the grave robber, and the highwayman. The others have either been slaughtered or are too injured to be of any use. In one heart-wrenching moment, the dog of the houndmaster nuzzles the body of their master, then rests its head on their corpse, a bond forged by battle and bloodshed. Fortunately, the dog is not left there, but the highwayman adopts the dog and joins them for the journey. The group moves to the sanctity of the chapel. There, the passenger gives the heroes the layout of the estate. They'll have to venture through the courtyard to the weald, enter the ruins, make their way down to the warrens, and finally, the darkest dungeon. Not since 1995's Mortal Kombat have I really enjoyed a movie adaptation of a video game like I have with Darkest Dungeon. The film pays proper homage to the video game and the Lovecraftian lore that inspired the game. It's one of the scarier film experiences I've had in recent years. The film takes some liberties with the limitations put out by the game. In the game, you can only have a party of four characters, but here we have five. Keeping within the regulations of the game, the characters we have in the party are those that are willing to fight alongside the Abomination. There are scenes of camping where the film fleshes out the characters and allows them to distress or improve their skills for the next battle. I heartily approve of the film's use of practical effects over CGI. Ask any actor and they will tell you that they would rather work with a puppet or an animatronic instead of a tennis ball that will be replaced with a CGI character. Darkest Dungeon does that in spades. The rabid dogs were real dogs with makeup appliances that give the illusion of exposed rib cages. The flesh is an updated version of Rob Bottin's work for John Carpenter's The Thing, and I mean that in the most flattering way possible. The Collector, when we first see it, is one of the most chilling entrances for a monster in the past decade. By far, my favorite has to be when the occultist performs the Unspeakable Commune, where he calls upon Eldritch entities to protect the party while they rest. You see these otherworldly tentacles embrace and wrap themselves around the bodies of everyone at the campfire. What I love about this is that you can see genuine reactions on the part of the cast members as they have something to act off of. Fede Alvarez of the 2013 Evil Dead remake is handling the directorial duties. Here, he's given a relatively small budget of $60 to $70 million to make Darkest Dungeon. From the atmosphere to the look of the costumes to the monsters, Alvarez is giving his signature to the world created by Red Hook Studios. In addition to bringing on Wayne June, Stuart Chatwood is back to compose the music. I've never given the music score of the game a dedicated listen, but there are cues in the film similar to those in the game. Other than the grandiose main theme, the music for the Hamlet is the track that sets the right tone. Casting is spot on with a mix of new talents and big names. As mentioned before, Wayne June from the video game reprises his role as the Ancestor, bringing some macabre humor and pitch-dark sarcasm to his narrations. Matilda Olivier, fresh off of Overlord, breaks out as the Gravedigger. We find out she grew up in a poor family and vowed to never live in such poverty again. When asked if she steals from anyone's grave, she replies, "No, just the rich." Only they are vain enough to be literally buried with their wealth. Tom Hardy brings an emotionally distant persona to the Highwayman. He's cold but skilled with his flintlocks and knives. Hardy is very much imitating Clint Eastwood from the Leone Spaghetti Westerns, with his limited dialogue but expressive facial gestures. Ifran Khan from Life of Pi and Jurassic World brings a dry sense of humor to the role of the occultist. While the other characters struggle to cope with the horrific sights that they're seeing, the occultist takes all this with great stride. For him, seeing eldritch monsters and otherworldly beasts are as common as birds and dogs. Nicholas Hoult of the recent X-Men films and Mad Max Fury Road plays the emotionally fragile Abomination. Escape Design FX did wonders for Hoult with regards to the transformations into his beastly form. From the sound editing to the makeup effects that seem straight out of American Werewolf in London, the Abomination makes the most of his screen time and not being overexposed. Letitia Wright of Black Panther has opened up a lot of eyes lately. To hear her voice and know she was under the mask of the Plague Doctor shows that she is a game actress. Hearing her with an English accent instead of Wakandan was jolting. It took a bit for me to recognize her voice, though. Her distant tones fits with the emotional barrier of the character, who has probably seen some serious shit in her day. Darkest Dungeon is the video game-based movie we've been waiting for. It properly respects the source material, but adds in elements that weren't possible in the game. Great performances and a palpable soundscape, and you have Alvarez and company deliver on a strong note. Why has it taken this long for a good video game-based movie? The best that I can figure, Hollywood sees video games as a competitor. Already, video gaming is a bigger industry than filmmaking. Why not embrace this and use it to bring in the bigger gaming crowd? If you do proper adaptations, people will come to the theaters. Instead, Hollywood seems stuck in their insecure ways and try to make gaming come off as inferior. All the while, the gaming industry is providing better stories and immersion. Next on the docket, we have the Black Widow movie from Marvel Studios. The film opens with an action sequence and an advanced idea mechanics laboratory. An explosion destroys the laboratory, and guards swarm the area. We cut to Agent Romanoff and Captain America, a cameo by Chris Evans, stealing the mutagenic formula for Project MODOK, aka Mental Organism Designed Only for Computing. They agree that the last thing they need is another Armin Zola and a repeat of Project Insight, which places the film after Winter Soldier but before Age of Ultron. After the successful mission, Cap is dismissed, but Colonel Fury wants Romanoff to stay back. He has another mission for her. Madam Mask has got her hands on some potent material that she intends to use for a weapon of mass destruction. Fury shows her satellite footage of experimentation using a red mist on a small village before the people are gunned down. Somehow, Mask has got her hands on the ether from Thor: The Dark World, which would be used to create the Reality Stone. Romanoff needs to interrogate scientific genius Bentley Whitman, who is suspected of being an associate for Madam Mask. He's going to be at a soiree with other scientists in Rio de Janeiro and may be trying to recruit others for Mask. Her name will appear on the list as Yelena Belova. Her tools for the mission: a ring that ejects a tranquilizer that will induce lightheadedness before kicking in as a truth serum, a pen that doubles as a smoke bomb, and a smartphone that can be used as a taser. She needs to pin down where Mask's operation is based out of. We cut to the soiree. Romanoff eyes Whitman. Here we see Romanoff use her feminine charms to disarm Whitman. Meanwhile, Whitman blathers about subatomic particles and how he strongly believes that there is a deeper level yet to be explored. Romanoff ejects the tranquilizer into the drink and is able to maintain casual appearances while the drug kicks in for Whitman. We find out that the red mist has origins that are not of this world. Whitman confesses that Mask's operations are in the Andes Mountains of Ecuador. As Romanoff leaves, she's followed by a large man with an arm sling. Outside, he grabs her and throws her in a nearby alley. She turns to see the man has thrown out the sling to reveal his arm as a gun. Nonchalantly, she says, "Hi, Carl." He gets angry at being called Carl and demands to be called by his codename, Bushwhacker. Romanoff just laughs. She dispatches Bushwhacker in decisive fashion. She shoves the pen up his nose and pushes the pin. Smoke fills the alley as she exits. With the location known, Romanoff is en route to Ecuador. She shares her info with Fury, and he informs her that Mask has called on a few associates to head security detail: Eric Williams, a.k.a. Grim Reaper, and Anthony Masters, a.k.a. Taskmaster. With Whitman opening his big mouth, the timetable has been pushed forward. Romanoff must sneak into the facility and prevent the launch of the weapon. Destroying the red mist wouldn't be a bad idea either. For a new movie, this gives me nostalgia. 2014 may not be that long ago, but 5 years can feel like a distant memory. 2014 was a good year for the MCU. Captain America, The Winter Soldier, and the first Guardians of the Galaxy. This movie doesn't feel like a paint-by-the-numbers origin movie. This is a standalone film that doesn't really add to the world-building, but plays with elements established in other films. I love that this is a film of a world that is lived in. No origins or time wasted on character backstory. And this film is so long overdue. The Black Widow is very much the MCU version of a James Bond movie. Much like Winter Soldier was a political thriller or Ant-Man was a heist movie, Black Widow isn't just a superhero movie, it's almost a different genre entirely. For this to work, Romanoff needs to exhibit feminine qualities, which was all the rage from SJWs on social media, who seem to resent women that exhibit femininity. I mean, just look at how they treated Alita Battle Angel. She uses those charms to lull her target and get the information she needs. She lures men in like a spider. Why else is she called the Black Widow? You think she gets that info from faux masculinity like Atomic Blonde? This was a quality of hers since we first met her in Iron Man 2 when she took down Tony in a skirmish, and this continued in The Avengers with her scenes of the Russian arms dealer in Loki, as well as in The Winter Soldier, where she used psychology to sneak past pursuers. It's great to see Marvel Studios harkening back to this part of the character. And for the fight sequences, I mean, she fights as I would expect a woman to fight a man. The fight scene between Bushwhacker and Romanoff is well choreographed, with Romanoff using her speed and agility to counterbalance Bushwhacker's strength. She takes out his legs and proceeds to go to town on his face after that. The later fight with Grim Reaper and Taskmaster is a nice switch from one of my favorite movie fights, the two-on-one fight from the Raid Redemption. Instead of two good guys against one bad guy, it's one good guy, or good girl, against two bad guys. As for the climactic fight between Romanoff and Madame Mask, well, you have to see it to believe it. Bond veteran Martin Campbell does the film justice, bringing in a mix of the polish of Brosnan's GoldenEye with the grittiness of Craig's Casino Royale. After the career of redemption that was The Foreigner with Jackie Chan and Pierce Brosnan, Campbell is back in top form. Adding to the Bond flavor is the music by David Arnold. In my teen years, I listened to the music score for Tomorrow Never Dies on a loop. Arnold primarily uses an electronic score but accents it with orchestral. Scarlett Johansson is clearly enjoying her chance to play the MCU James Bond. She amps up the sex appeal and plays well off of Jackson's Fury and Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Whitman. Her emotional versatility shows in her eyes between the lighter moments of the film and tense sequences. Madame Mask gets the Darth Vader treatment. Stuntwoman Zoe Bell, famous for being strapped to the hood of a car during one of the most tense chases ever on film in Death Proof, does the physical acting for Mask. And does it very well. But her voice is none other than Broadway legend and Animaniacs alumni, Bernadette Peters. Taskmaster gets the same treatment. Ray Park handles the physicality, while Michael Wincott performs the voiceover. When Darth Maul is handling the fighting, you know you're in for a good show. Wincott is one of those often overlooked character actors, known for quirky roles. Robin Hood, King of Thieves, The Count of Monte Cristo, the recent Westworld TV show. He was the main baddie in The Crow with Brandon Lee. Grim Reaper was another smart pick with regards to fight choreography. Gary Daniels handles the scythe like a pro. Former pro wrestler Robert Mallet has his time to shine as Bushwhacker. The Black Widow is a truly enjoyable MCU entry that doesn't set anything up. It's a standalone film with characters we've gotten to know and introduces some new characters in clever ways. It's a throwback to a period when the MCU was more adventurous with what it offered movie viewers. And again, where has this movie been? World War Z starts off with notes from a Chinese doctor dealing with a patient that shows anatomical evidence that they are deceased, yet they are moving and showing concerning aggression. From there, the zombie outbreak spreads throughout Southeast Asia, no thanks in part to the Oregon black market. Over the course of the 2.5-hour mockumentary of World War Z, we learn of man's battle against extinction at the hands of the zombie hordes. From Israel to the Battle of Yonkers to the Jurassic Redeker plan, we see how the old world is transformed into a new world. Diehards will be saddened to see a lot of the content from the book left out. My personal favorite segment from the book was the use of dachshunds to trip zombies and allow a soldier more time to reload or plan another means of defense. But you get all the key bits here from the Max Brooks novel. Adding to that immersion is the casting of real military figures along with acting talent. One moment you have the likes of Ben O'Toole or Marcus Lyle Brown bringing the drama and the tension, and then in the next segment you have General Austin S. Miller or General Michael X. Garrett providing the specs and details that give the film its credibility. Some excellent names were cast in the documentary, providing voiceover for the letters and notes and journals. While they may not be immediately familiar upon hearing them, they are top talent. Bebe Neuwirth, Nathan Fillion, Alfred Molina, and Peter Mensah give convincing voices to these faceless characters. The inclusion of photos, music, and grainy footage bring this dark world to life. The experience of past topics like baseball, jazz, and the Civil War gave Ken Burns the tools to make us believe this nightmare scenario could happen. I know the Brad Pitt film has its fans, but this is the method of adaptation that World War Z deserved. What we got with Pitt's film was a generic zombie movie that rode the fast zombies trend wagon. Even more sad considering we've had running zombies long before 28 Days Later. Albeit, I really like the music score by Muse, as well as actress Daniela Curtiz as Sagan. Even more evident is the limited scope of the film. We really only got Pitt's story. With World War Z from Ken Burns, we actually get an oral history that was the makeup of the book by Max Brooks. This event affected billions of people. This film tries to bring in more perspective, more insight. A Chinese doctor, a soldier at Ground Zero for the Battle of Yonkers, a hired bodyguard for the rich and famous, an Israeli analyst. This is not just the story of a handful of people, this is the story of mankind coming back from the bottom of the food chain. The music used in the film is primarily ambiance or mood drones. For the tense, suspenseful sections, Claudio Simonetti of Goblin was at the composition helm. For the moments where action was being described, Paul Blachek pulls off the John Carpenter-style synth, akin to his work on Dying Light. I couldn't be happier with how this version of World War Z turned out. Given the people involved, it's as best an adaptation as one could ask for from one of my all-time favorite books. You get sucked into this world, and for as horrific a picture the mockumentary paints, you're engrossed from beginning to end. And that finishes this round of back catalog for Mac and the Movies. Thanks for listening. Next Monday on April 8th, I'll be taking a look at the films of Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Marc Caro. If you enjoy this episode, feel free to give it a like and leave a comment. If you want to stay on top of future episodes, go ahead and follow me on Podomatic or subscribe on one of the other available outlets, iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play Music. I'm on both Facebook and Twitter. You can reach out to me via Gmail. I also have a PayPal for those who wish to give a one-time donation for the program. All of it's in the description. Until next time, this is Mackenzie Lambert from Mac and the Movies. Take care, folks. Here. I wanted to go ahead and inform you that this was the April Fool's episode for Mac and the Movies. This idea came up from a conversation I had a few years ago with my friend Mike. We talked about working on a collaboration, and one of the ideas I kicked in was an idea of doing a countdown for our favorite movies that did not exist or that existed in parallel universes. But as happens in life, plans changed. I'm not primarily uploading on YouTube like I did at the time, and the collaboration never came to be. So I figured I'd have a little fun for April 1st and bring back this idea. You can expect it to be a yearly tradition. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you continue to listen. Cheers.